This podcast is part of a series of public talks given by Swami Mukti Bodhananda during her visit to Vancouver, Canada in 2016. Swami Mukti Bodhananda, a direct disciple of Paramhansa Swami Satyananda Sarasvati, is a Yogacharya, living master of yoga. Her passion and work is facilitating people worldwide in the process of yoga. For more information, you can visit her website at muktibodharetreatscanada.com.
So it's so wonderful to be here in Vancouver and lovely groups of people that I meet, very receptive to the practice. And we're all at different stages. I went to India when I was 17 by a week. I'd been practicing yoga for 5 years. I started when I was 12. At that stage in Australia, this is 1972, there was really only one yoga school, and then there were one or two other teachers, and you could do it by watching the television, and it's what I used to call leotard yoga. Yeah. But at the Gita school, they also offered the deeper aspects, the esoteric aspects. And my mother used to bring books home, and I used to love reading them. It fascinated me. And I used to think about this brotherhood that they spoke of in the Andes, where everybody was devoted to spiritual life, and they just wore plain clothes and grew their own vegetables and didn't worry too much about having fancy hairstyles or lots of jewellery. And I was thinking, wouldn't that be fabulous? Mm-hmm. And when I ended up in India, and it was a bit like that, I thought, wow, I was thinking about that and here I am. So many years later. In fact, Peter and I were just discussing that, how we say something and then we find it happening. And this is so important also with your yoga practice, because if you want to achieve something in your yoga, if you want to aspire towards attaining something at any level, whether it's physical, emotional, mental, you put in the practice and it will happen. And you know when it happens? When you forget about it. Anything in life unfolds when you have the desire and it's felt deep within yourself. I'm not talking about something superficial. You feel it deep within yourself and then it unfolds. When I was about 12, I just started secondary school, and my mother said, so what are you going to do when you leave school? And I've always been the sort of person that looks into myself, and it's whatever I see in my mind's eye. And I said, I see myself in an institution involved in the teaching. I said, I don't know in what capacity, but this is what I see. I wasn't thinking what I wanted to do, it's what I saw inwardly. Again, that's what happened at the Bihar School of Yoga. I ended up teaching there. And the yoga ashram was very much about karma yoga, which is the yoga of work and service. And do you know what karma yoga is? Nearly everyone knows karma yoga, yeah. And very few people are actually given the yoga that you're doing here to practice, but Swami Satyananda gave me the physical practice as well as meditations to do. And when I was writing Hatha Yoga Pradipika, then I did the practices there. Some of them didn't suit me. Have you read Hatha Yoga Pradipika? Yeah, some of the practices a little bit odd, let's say. Are you wondering what those practices are? Well, one in particular, it's called Bhasti, and basically it's an enema, but in ancient times people would stand in a river to do it, and they would use their abdominal muscles with Uddiyan Bandha and suck the stomach lock and suck the water up from the river. So we lived very close to the Ganga River, the Ganges. I wasn't going to stand in the Ganges and do that. Upstream at the source, it's very clean, but downstream, yes, well. So that was one practice that I wasn't going to do, but the others I did. And so it was through my own personal practice that I came to understand many of the techniques and what the yogis write about them, from my perspective, was true. Bar one thing, when again you read the Hatha Yoga Pratipika, they always say that when you do this particular asana or bandha, that it will kill all the intestinal worms. Living in India for 10 years and then returning, even after 10 years, I had amoebas and protozoas in my gut from India. So I can't verify that the asana and the other practice will, you know, get rid of your intestinal worms. You might need that special chocolate that you eat if you get it from the chemist or a naturopathic treatment. But apart from that, you know, what's written in these texts is the experience of the yogis. And it's been proven again and again by the practitioners that what they've written and said does happen. And so if you want to experience the subtler aspects of yoga, and when I say subtler, I mean the inner aspects, keep up your practice because it will unfold for you. It will happen. Sometimes people practice and they go, ah, not really experiencing anything, and then give up. But we never know when we plant the seed when it's going to germinate and when it's going to blossom. So the yoga seed is quite different to the other seeds that you plant in the soil. The yoga seed will flourish when your internal soil is ready. So that internal soil is the mind. And therefore, in the yoga techniques, particularly in Hatha Yoga Pratipika, there are many cleansing practices. And these may involve drinking saline water, or they may involve doing specific types of breathing or focusing the eyes, thratak. And when you do the cleansing practices, they're called shatkarma. There are six branches of the shatkarma. When you do these cleansing practices, you're not just cleansing your physical body, you're cleansing your emotions and your mind. And so we start last group. Yeah. Do you notice that the mind is very clear after that practice? Yeah. And so what I suggest to people is that to take yoga off the mat, as we say these days, to snack on the yoga. And what that means is, for example, if you're tossing and turning at night because your mind is plagued with a particular scenario, you may want to even just sit on the end of your bed or sit on a chair and do kapalbhati. This will quieten the mind so that when you lie down, you're able to drift off. I call that snacking on yoga. So you're not doing the yoga for an experience of meditation. You're doing that yoga to quieten the mind. The ashram life was very challenging for many people, not everyone, most people, because we were faced with our mind. I was saying before to Padma how in the monsoon season, who's lived in India? Yeah, long time, short time, south? No. Sorry? North. In the north, whereabouts?
Near Delhi.
Near Delhi. So you know what monsoon's like. Yeah. And you're... Okay. Anyone else? I didn't see over this side. Yeah, long time, short time. Okay, yep. So you may not have experienced the monsoon season. You did. Okay. Yeah. So what happens in monsoon, you would have experienced this with all that constant rain and everything wet, it affects the emotions. Did you notice that? Yeah. And so in an ashram environment where everyone's getting emotional, and then there are certain restrictions, and the first challenging restriction is your food, because there's not as much that's growing at that time of year, or it's not accessible. And so you have a small amount of food, and you're starting to get hungry, because it's not your choice to eat less. I mean, for 4 years I had one meal a day, but that was my choice. It wasn't force of circumstance. And so you're thinking, well, why am I putting up with this? I come from a country that has abundant food. I can access food. Why am I doing this to myself? And so, you know, there's a lot of self-reflection that goes on in these circumstances. And then there's no escape from that if you choose to continue on. You have to wait till the monsoon season changes. So what happens is you go through this process of what we call tapasya. You've heard the word tapasya. You're firing the body and the mind through austerities. Now, if you choose to lead an austere life outside of an ashram, that is your choice. But when it's inflicted on you, then the ego rebels. And this is really the first thing that we find in that sort of restricted environment, is that we're faced with our egos and managing the ego. And what happens is, outside in society, everyone's ego is running loose. And our egos collide with each other. And so we may go off in different directions because we disagree. But in an ashram, you can't. You're forced to face that situation and reflect upon yourself. And so I found that living that sort of life and then coming out into the world and living in the world, it has given me a foundation from where I can see that the practices of yoga can be used to strengthen our inner self so that we can manage these situations, or we could use them, the practices of yoga, to escape ourselves. So what is really important is developing this ability to step back and watch and witness. And the talk the other night was on getting out of your own way. And really, you know, what I'm talking to you about to you now is an extension of that. It's getting out of your own way. It's seeing the ego driving your life or driving your practice. It might be that the practice you're doing is done out of that state of ego. I can do this asana. Looking out of the corner of your eye, yes, I'm better than that other person. Or I'm not as good as that other person. But really, the asana is a process of meditation where your body is moving to channel the energies into a still state, so that you can sit comfortably for your pranayama. You can direct that energy up into the higher brain centers, and then you go out into your state of meditation. So the urban yogi has many challenges here. One is the challenge of continuing practice, because life gets in the way. The second challenge is the ego. And the third challenge that I perceive is developing a deeper meditative state. Yeah. When I first came to yoga, I came because I wanted to give up ballet. My mother had taken me to ballet from the age of 6. By the age of 12, I'd had enough and I spoke up. And so we looked for another form of exercise. I came to yoga because I was looking for exercise. Who has come here for that purpose? Who came to yoga for exercise? So is that about half? About half. Who came for another reason? Do you mind me asking?
To relieve
the pain from exercise. Fantastic. Has it worked for you? Fantastic.
To understand my grandparents.
Yep, okay. Who else came for another reason?
To know God.
To know God, yep.
To explore something that I felt was in me.
Yeah.
To know how to express it.
Yeah. 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 And do you find yourself coming closer to that?
Slowly.
Slowly. Great. Yeah. So we're all at different stages here. I came for physical reasons. And then what I found was that it was assisting me at that deeper level you were talking about, but also for channeling my emotions. And so for those of you who've come for the physical exercise, do you feel that yoga's given you something more than that? Does everyone here feel that? Has given them something more? Yeah, this is the beauty of yoga. It's fantastic. You come for that physical reason. I'm just generalising because a lot of people come for that reason more than the other reasons. And then you find, oh, there's something else in it. And that something else is you. Yeah. And some people think, oh, yoga's a religion or it's a cult. You know, people end up wearing orange and shaving their head. Yeah, I did that too. And in my yoga life, I wear my yoga uniform because that expresses the inner me and my purpose in life. Nothing to do with a cult. And in the ashram, shave the head for many reasons. One, you don't need shampoo. Two, you don't need to look in the mirror and see if you're beautiful or not. And so the other reason is for meditation. I was mentioning this before in another talk, that in meditation, the head generates a lot of heat. So when you practice yoga, you feel the heat in your body too, don't you? Has anyone noticed the heat in the head? Yeah, so shaving the head, I'm not saying go home and shave your head, if you want to, fine, but shaving the head releases that heat. In a place like India where I was living, 40 degrees in summer was a cool day. Yeah, and no fans, no air conditioning. But in winter, then we didn't shave our heads because you lose heat and then you get cold. So you're sensible about when and where you do these things. And so with this process of the yoga that you're doing, do you have an intention? I understand what you've said, and there's not many people who are intending to experience that. Some of us might be questioning what that is. And so when you practice your yoga, do you have an intention of why you're doing it? Everyone have an intention? Yeah. And do you feel that your yoga is getting you there with that? Fantastic. Yeah, that's great. And so I feel also that my intentions, whatever they were, are being fulfilled. And when you channel that energy that you generate through your yoga towards your intention, then you're coming into what I call the authentic self. and you're expressing that out into society. And so in this way, you are indirectly or directly influencing the society. Yeah, it's very important that we understand we do it for ourselves, but the brain has mirror neurons in it. And so as you do your yoga and then you interact with other people, you influence other people through your mirror neurons. When you're talking to somebody, if they're standing like this, you start to do that yourself. Or if you get an itch and go like that, then they start to do that too. Has anyone noticed this happen? Yeah. So it's through your yoga practice in that way also of interacting with people, your yogic presence, you exude it. You may not notice it. You look in the mirror and you see you. But you will be exuding this at an energetic level. And those attitudes you develop through your yoga influences other people. You know, when you live with someone, you start looking like each other the longer you live with them. Yeah. And so this is part of the mirror neurons. It's not just mannerisms. It's thought patternings. And when you sit in a car, has this happened to you? You're thinking something and then the other person voices it. Something about that close confinement of being in the car. You've got to be careful what you think. But this is what happens, you know, in society. You might be sitting on a bus and you start thinking something and it's actually not your thought. Have you had that happen to you? You think, where did that come from? That's not the sort of thing I would normally think. Yeah. So we pick up information from other people just being in close proximity. The benefit of you doing your yoga is that it will influence the people around you, just subtly. And so what I find interesting is that yoga goes back thousands and thousands of years. We don't know exactly how far back it goes. The books of the Veda, they're possibly 4,000 to 5,000 years old, but the knowledge that they're talking about is older than that. Could be 10,000 years old. The process of Ayurveda, you know Ayurveda? Healing with herbs, lengthening the life, extending the lifespan, Ayurveda, through herbal remedies, all sorts of herbal remedies. And so that knowledge was known before people could write, and it was passed on verbally. And then eventually it's written down. And so this information that we have about yoga, it is so ancient. And the first yogi that we know of is called Shiva. So in Hatha Yoga Pratipika, you'll find the first verse is that we acknowledge Shiva, Adinath, Adi first, Natha, Lord, the first Lord as Shiva. And the information of all the practices comes from the first known physical guru person is Matsyendranath. So you know Matsyendrasana, spinal twist? This is named after Matsyendranath. And the word Matsya, do you know what Matsya is? Yeah, Matsya is fish. Indra is Lord of the senses, and Natha also means Lord, but Natha is a specific sect of yogis. They're also known as Kanfata. They pierce their ear or both ears and wear a very large earring, a round earring. And what's interesting, it's actually not through the lobe but through that gristly part of the ear. Any acupuncturists here? I'm curious to know there must be points here in the ear. Yeah, because they put it right through here, massive earring. Quite often they wear a turban. So Matsyendranath was a fisherman, and that was his day job, and he was also a yogi. He was also a siddha. Siddha means somebody who has practiced yoga to the point of attaining perfections, siddhi. And when you practice yoga long enough, you do develop certain siddhis. These perfections may manifest, as Patanjali talks about in the Yoga Sutras, as vibhuti. Do you know the Yoga Sutra section, the chapter on vibhuti? So he talks about things like clairvoyance, clairaudience, and various siddhis that unfold. Matsyendranath was a fisherman. He had a day job, like many urban yogis. We have a day job, or it might be a night job. You do shift work, and then you do your yoga. So that says to me, you know, the life wasn't so different at that level. And Matsyendranath, who's acknowledged as the guru in Hatha Yoga Pradipika, his disciple Goriknath was, he was a cowboy. Gorik or Goriksha is horse. So he was Lord of the Horses. And he rode around India teaching yoga. He and Matsyendranath had very special relationship, very close. And Goriknath also developed many siddhis, many powers, and he actually became more powerful with his siddhis than Matsyendranath. And one time Matsyendranath became enamored with the Queen of Assam. The Assamese women are very, very beautiful. And he went and lived with her for a long time. And so Goriknath was missing his guru and rode up on his horse, and in his own language, not modern-day language, but let's say his modern-day, and he'd be saying, "Hey, dude, what are you doing? you're enamored with this beautiful woman, but we got work to do here." So these were real people. They lived real lives, and it happens to all of us, doesn't it? We sort of go off on a tangent for a while, believing whatever the story is. But keep doing your yoga. Don't stop doing your yoga. Yoga is the foundation of whatever tangent you go off on. Yeah. So Matsyendranath, Goriknath, they were urban yogis in their day. And now we are the urban yogis here, discovering about ourselves, finding out about ourselves. And it can be useful to have a diary. I don't know if you do this. And sometimes just write down your inner experiences for you, not for somebody else. This is really, really personal. Write it down after you've done a practice, might be after a class here, and what you felt inwardly. Maybe some emotion came up, you're angry about some situation in life. Write it down. Because many years later, when you reflect back on that, you will see many different things about that situation. Maybe that how caught you were in it, and now you've gained so much more maturity, you can see how you're more able to step out of these emotional situations. Or not. Yeah. Does anyone keep a diary just out of interest? Yeah? Yeah. It can be very useful. I mean, some people don't want to do that, and that's fine, but I'm just saying it helps in the process of reflection. I used to write my dreams down because I'm very visual, and a lot of my information comes to me through dreams. So I'd write that down. And it was very, very interesting to look back at that many years later. I could see how my subconscious was understanding and processing something. And then the knowledge I gained years later had actually manifested. It had taken years to understand a particular situation. Yeah. Or what might have been expressing was one of the chakras was going through a process of purification. So I may have been expressing that through the dream. The urban yogi, for me, is a person who does a regular practice and brings their inner experience into their day-to-day life. Whatever that inner experience is, it's a realization of some sort. And you live that in your day-to-day life. You might have a different idea of what an urban yogi is. Does anyone want to express what they think an urban yogi is? No ideas?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I agree with what you said.
Yeah.
You have that yoga practice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it's supported by your practice. So your external life is supported by your practice. So if you're not doing your practice, what's your support? It might be alcohol, drugs, caffeine, sex. You know, you look to other ways of supporting yourself that really don't work. Ultimately, it's those other ways are escaping yourself. The yoga process is supporting yourself. Yeah. And when I say drugs, I mean, this is interesting because today there's so many drugs around. In ancient times in India, there was a plant called soma. And they would pick the soma at a specific moon phase. It would flower. It's a vine, creeper, it was. And they would pick the flower at a specific time and put it in a clay pot under earth for a period of time. And they would use this process of the transformation of the plant as aushadhi to induce a specific chemical state in the mind. And it was only the Brahmin priests who were doing this, because they would do a lot of yoga practice in preparation. They would prepare their bodies and their minds for this soma plant. And what happened, I'm going back thousands of years ago in the history of India. The Kshatriya class, who are the warriors and also the kings, they said, We want to experience this. You look like you're having fun. And the Brahmin said, you can't. You haven't done the groundwork. You haven't done the practice. So the Kshatriyas, being the warriors they were at sword point, they forced the Brahmins to give them this soma. I think today maybe it was something like ayahuasca, maybe. And so the Brahmins were forced by the Kshatriyas to give them this plant, and what happened was they went crazy. They went absolutely mad because they could not handle the experience. And so what happened in India is that the Brahmin priests gradually eradicated soma from the whole country. There is no soma plant there anymore. There's other plants like marijuana, and you see the sadhus. You know, sadhus are wandering mendicant. They renounce their life, and their worldly life. If they are devotees of Shiva, they let their hair grow long, and they'll have a chillum and sing Bom Bom Mahadeva. Yeah, and so this is their way of contacting the divine through devotion, actually. It's through that process of devotion. And really, when you go to India, if you see this, it's the Shaivites that follow that process. And everybody joins in on Shivaratri, which is the no moon day. I don't know what you call no moon day. It's when you can't see the moon. Usually it's in March. It's a particular month. You call it new moon, do you? Yep, so you can't see the moon. It's the last day of the dark fortnight. And what people do in India, I don't know about the big cities these days, but this is the tradition. Everyone meditates on Shiva. Shiva is consciousness. And Shakti is energy. These are the two eternal principles within the individual, within the cosmos, the universe. And so people fast during the day. It's a public holiday. In fact, there are so many religious events in India. Every day is a public holiday for somebody. But on this particular day, people fast, and in the evening they have a drink with milk and they crush poppy seeds and they put some bhang. Bhang is some form of marijuana. I'm not quite sure which form, but it's green and mushy. And they put it in the drink and mix it up, and everyone has a drink and sings kirtan all night and eats sweets. Thinking of Shiva, Bom Bom Mahadeva. And well, it's for fun, but it's also to let go of the ego and enjoy and to sing God's name so that you can imbibe that into your life. So what happens is then with this ritual of, I was talking about the soma before, they called it aushadhi. Aushadhi means this herbal preparation to transcend the normal state of mind through herbs. But these days, aushadhi is something like naturopathy. It's not what I was talking about, the soma plant. So there are various ways of trying to expand your mind into another state of being other than the limited state of mind. And one of these processes is the yoga that you're doing. One of these processes is the karma yoga I spoke of before. Then there is the bhakti yoga, like singing of the kirtan and singing of God's name as mantra. When I say God's name, I mean divine, divinity, trying to understand what is that subtle state that is beyond the finite mind. You know what I mean by finite mind? We put everything in boxes and say the world has to be like this. We don't think outside the box. That's what I mean by the finite mind. There are many ways of doing things. And so to understand divinity, we need to step outside of the box and look beyond what we're saying can't be done. So we sing mantras, bhakti yoga, and then raja yoga, the yoga of meditation. So in the hatha yoga pradipika, it says that that process of hatha yoga is for the purpose of raja yoga meditation. It doesn't speak about the bhakti yoga. It doesn't speak about the karma yoga. It speaks about the physical yoga and meditation. So this physical yoga has actually been taken out of a much broader science, tantra. And tantra was very, very expansive. It included the aushadhi. It included ritual. It included meditating on a specific aspect of the divine as if it were physical, giving it a physical form so that the mind can understand it. That might seem like religion. When you go to India, there are all these temples, Durga and Hanuman and Shiva, and from the Western point of view, excuse me, we see that as a religion. It's actually a way of life. It's a way of thinking. It's like Buddhism. I mean, we call it a religion, but it's a way of life, a way of thinking, a way of being. And Hinduism's really like that too. And yoga's come out of that. Yoga is a philosophy. There are six philosophies. Yoga is one of those philosophies. Yoga and Sankhya, they're very interrelated. And Patanjali's Yoga Sutras are very much based on this aspect of Sankhya. How am I going for time? I haven't got a clock here. Sorry, I can just keep talking on that. It's my hobby. 8:15. All right. Wow, that went quickly for me. How are you? You okay? Falling asleep yet? No one's going like that. So the Sankhya philosophy went out of fashion because it was based on very strong austerities. And these strong austerities might be, for example, when you do an asana where you stand on one foot and you have the other foot on the inner thigh. What do you call that? Vrikshasana? Okay, so I have different names. You know, in north of India, south of India, traditions can be slightly different, and so different names. So imagine you're doing Vrikshasana, standing in a river, 24 hours, 48 hours, 1 week. How do you eat? Someone comes and feeds you. How do you go to the toilet? Then and there. You know, this is the type of austerity that was done. And people started saying, not really into that. So that part of Sankhya fell by the wayside, but the philosophy remained. And Sankhya means number, actually, and it enumerates the aspects of the mind. Now, in yoga, we also look at aspects of the mind. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras deals with mind more than the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. Hatha Yoga Pradipika deals with the body and subtle experiences of sound, inner experiences of sound. But then, as it says in the beginning, this is the stairway to Raj Yoga. So your Hatha Yoga will take you to meditation. Then you pick up the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras after the Hatha Yoga. The aspects of mind. We've spoken about ego. What do you think would be another aspect of mind? Yes, this is a layer of mind. Yeah. So there are three layers in the mind that we understand. There's the conscious, where you're awake. Then there's the subconscious, when you're in dream state. And then there's the unconscious, where you don't know anything. You know that state of sleep where you've been somewhere, you're not sure where, but you feel rested and rejuvenated. Yeah, the unconscious state of sleep. There is a fourth state of mind beyond all of that. In yoga, it's called Turiya. Have you heard that word, Turiya? Yeah. So Turiya is where you go into deep meditation and it'll be in the latter stages of samadhi. So this is a layer of mind. The ego is present in all those layers. Okay? The ego doesn't disappear in unconscious sleep. Ego is still there, but it's resting, it's quiet. And you open your eyes, conscious, and gradually it kicks in again. And have you noticed with young children, when they're really small, the ego is really, what's the word I'm looking for? It's quiet. And then gradually they start to come into their ego, some sooner than others. I mean, they all have an ego at two. No. No. Yeah. But they're still not completely in themselves. Have you noticed that? Yeah, so the ego is not totally, I'm going to use the word solid. It's still being formed and moulded. And then when the baby goes to sleep, if you notice that real quietness? Yeah. It's not just that the baby's sleeping, it's almost like there's a body there, but where is the baby's consciousness or whatever you want to call it? Have you noticed that? It's almost like they're not present. The body's there and they're not present. Whereas with adults, it's still there. Anyone observe that? Yeah, yeah. So this ego, this is what we're dealing with as urban yogis. It goes to sleep at night, and that's very nice. And then it wakes up in the day and it starts throwing itself around. And it's like a front seat driver or a back seat driver. You're trying to drive your car and it keeps telling you what to do. And one day you get fed up with it. Because you suddenly realise through your yoga practice that actually inwardly you know better. There's another thing that interferes. What do you think that might be? I'm talking about the inner you knows better, but there's another part of your mind that interferes. What would that be?
Doubt.
What's the doubt connected to?
Fear. Attachments.
Yes, okay. But that's conditioning. That's memory. Memory. Yes, memory and where your conditionings are. Yes, that interferes. So that's another aspect of mind, memory.
Emotions.
Sorry?
Emotions.
Emotions. That's amazing. It's the mind in motion. Yeah. And I wonder, is emotion in the mind? I do wonder where the emotion is. In Sankhya, it's really interesting. Sankhya and yoga, we don't talk a lot about emotion. Tantra does, bhakti yoga does. Well, this is why I'm saying, I wonder where the emotions are. Yeah. They're connected with your memory. Definitely they're connected with memory. Mm. One other aspect is the intellect. You know, your inner self is telling you some information. Your inner self, your intuitive mind is telling you information, and then you say to yourself, oh, don't be silly, you know, and you listen to your intellect. Mm-hmm. And afterwards you go, oh, I knew I shouldn't have done that. We do it all the time, don't we? The purpose of yoga is to enable you to listen to yourself and act on it. To actually act on it, knowing that that's the right thing that you need to be doing for you. Sometimes we don't know, I understand, we keep weighing things up. But sometimes we really do know. But we doubt ourselves because the intellect kicks in and starts telling us other stories. Maybe the story is something that parents have told you when you're really young, or grandparents, or aunts, or uncles, or something you've seen on the television, or something you learnt at school. You're not quite sure where that intellectual information is coming from. But it steers you off your inner path that's right for you. You might call that dharma. Some people call that dharma. You know the word dharma. It means right path for you. And what your dharma is not my dharma. So I can't say to you that what you're doing is wrong. I wouldn't do it. But you feel inwardly, deeply within you, that that's right for you. So when I went to India, my grandparents were jumping up and down. And they said, oh, you're going to shave your head and put on orange clothes. I said, probably. But I didn't let their fears or their understandings influence, because I knew what was right for me. I knew it was right for me. I also knew that if I didn't do it when I did do it, that I would have to do it at some stage and it would be harder because I'd be older. I knew that too. So I did it. We don't live forever. And if there's something you haven't done and you're hankering to do it, work out how you can do it in a conducive way. Otherwise, at the end of your life, you'll be having regrets. And if you believe in reincarnation, that story will keep on going. So yoga is the process whereby you work with your body to come into your inner self, to believe what you know is true for you. To come into your quiet state of inner being, which connects you to that greater consciousness. And I was talking about this, I don't know if it was yesterday, but recently, that one of the aspects of Sankhya, which is the same in yoga, the philosophies overlap here at this point, is that that collective consciousness and universal consciousness that is within every one of us is described as the sunlight which emanates out everywhere in our universe. And it reflects off the planets, for example. It reflects off the moon. So we're standing here, and we've just had full moon on Thursday, and we're saying, wow, look at the full moon. And we're thinking, look at the moonlight on the trees and the water. Isn't it beautiful, this moonlight? Has the moon got any light? Yeah. Yeah. And that's how it is for us. Our minds are like the moon, reflecting the sunlight. So our minds are reflecting that greater consciousness. And when we understand that, we're all one experience here. It's just our minds that are separate. Isn't that amazing? That consciousness reflecting off everyone's mind here. I get goosebumps. The mind's different. The mind isn't self-luminous, but it's able to reflect that consciousness. And as you practice your yoga, that's what it tunes you into. That inner consciousness is your inner authentic self. And it's in everything. It's reflecting off every atom. And we as humans have the capacity to experience that. This is snacking on yoga. Reminding yourself of that in the moments of life. Yeah. And so the purpose of your yoga practice is to believe yourself. Just know that's true. You will feel it in your heart of hearts, whatever you want to call that heart space. You feel it in here when something's true. We've got three spaces from where we experience intuitive knowledge. So intuitive knowledge as instinct is in the gut, gut instinct we call it. And these days they're talking about the brain in the gut. And that gut feeling in yoga is called dahara akasha. Dahara is the abdominal area, D-A-H-A-R-A, dahara, and akasha is space. So in this case, the space is like, it could be a screen or it could be like in outer space. We feel in the gut. And I use that intuitive or instinctive knowledge to know whether a certain food is good for me. So in the supermarket, there's all new things presenting all the time. Chia seeds and quinoa, I mean, they're not so new now, but just giving you an idea. So I'll pick up a packet of it. And if that food's not good for me, my gut tightens. I don't get a breath in. If I pick up something that's good for me, I get an expansion in the abdomen and a deep breath in. And I know that's right because I've had foods tested with a Morrow machine, which is a bioenergy machine, maybe like a Vega machine or so many machines out there, bioenergy machines. So that has actually shown that my personal experience is correct. Yeah. So I have faith in that. I use that all the time. I use it for foods mainly. The next space of the heart space, we call it Hridaya Kasha. Hridaya is heart. And Akasha, again, that same space. So sometimes when, for example, and it could happen in Dahara Akasha or Hridaya Akasha, someone asks you to do something and you go tight there. You know that feeling? And you say yes anyway, but you really don't want to, and you feel it in there. How do we find the courage? How do we find the words to listen to that and refuse the other person? This is what we're looking for, the answer to listening to ourselves. So I listen to that, and my go-to answer is, I love you dearly, but I can't do it, blah, 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 blah. Or I love you dearly another time. You find your own words, how you're going to express that. Or I'd love to, but another time. You don't have to give excuses. You don't have to make up stories. You don't want to do it for whatever reason. You'll have your own valid reason. The most important thing is you're feeling it in here. No. Okay? It's not being selfish. It's listening to yourself. We tie ourselves in knots because we start thinking that we should be doing it. I mean, sometimes there are situations where, like with parents or children or friends or whatever, where there are things that we have to do. We are obliged at some level. I understand that. I'm not talking about situations like that, but I'm just talking about those occasions that arise. Or sometimes maybe, for example, after a yoga class and someone, I'm saying cornered, but you're not really cornered, and they're talking at you and you just want to get away. But you keep listening. And inside you're thinking, no. You know that experience? Again, gotta go, grab the hands, love you, bye. Yeah.
What's the third plane?
Oh, yes, we finish with that and we'll do Om. It's the space of what we call the consciousness, Chid Akash. Chid is consciousness, Akash is space or screen. We describe that as being behind the forehead. So when you close your eyes, you're looking into the back of your eyelids and you might see imagery. You take your awareness up that little bit higher. And if you're finding that challenging, just be aware of what you see in front of your closed eyes. Yeah. So Chid Akash presents as an image or an idea. The space in the heart is a feeling. The space in the gut is a feeling, but it's very visceral. Yeah, it's quite different to the heart space feeling. So these are the three different spaces that we receive information. And you may notice, oh yeah, I always get my information here. Or in different situations, in different places. Or sometimes it's a combination of all of that. So after your yoga practice, when you sit or when you lie down, if you do a shavasana after your asana, you're feeling the information that's coming to you in one of these three areas or all those areas. Yeah. And remember that everything is information. Everything. Somebody's angry in front of you. It's information. But what happens is we take on their anger or we take on their emotion. We take on their vibration. That's just information. Let it go. Listen to you. Your information about you. Yeah. And this is how we develop our experience as urban yogis. When I went to US a couple of years ago, I discovered chocolate yoga. And I only recently found out what it was. And Doga has now hit Australia just recently. And apparently there's Koga and there's disco yoga too. There's aerial yoga in Australia. I don't know if there's disco yoga. And, you know, look, the essence of yoga is really about human evolution. And so wherever we, at whatever level we come to yoga at, it's going to assist us to evolve. If we just do it for physical reason, I understand what you're saying about the groundwork, but what is the groundwork for yoga? It's a little bit different to ingesting chemicals. Like the soma was a chemical. That's a little bit different. It does. But at some stage, the ego is going to go bang. And you're going to find out the hard way. Life teaches us like that. And if that is a person's journey, it'll happen through yoga. It'll happen through anything. I mean, in the ashram in India, I've seen people's egos explode. And I was thinking, oh, maybe Swamiji will do that to me. put me in a situation where, you know, I'm going, yes, I'm really good, and then bang. I don't know. Australians are a little bit irreverent. I don't know that it happens to them so often. I guess it does if you're a politician, an Australian politician. No, we're all human beings. And if your ego is wanting to do that, it will do it through any means. Nothing's going to stop it until the person sees themselves. So, really, what are we doing here on the earth plane? We're either unconsciously or consciously evolving. And what you're talking about with ego is the process of when the awakening happens at Manipur, the navel center chakra. So at the level of Muladhara, there's a lot of unconscious stuff happening, and at Swadhisthan, subconscious, and then the ego expresses at a conscious level. And depending on a person's makeup and personality, they may need that experience in order to understand their inner self. And if that's their process, it's okay, it's their process. That's their path. It's not my problem. And I'm not saying that in a sense to abdicate responsibility. I'm just saying I'm responsible for my own evolution. That person's responsible for themselves. And, for example, here we're having this discussion where I'm doing all the talking mainly. But it's up to you to take that information on. And if you don't want that information, fine. So with that person, like you're saying with the ego, and I can do these asanas, I think they have competitions now, I read somewhere. Is it in Canada too? I don't know if it's in Australia. I think it was in US. They have asana competitions. So for me, from my perspective, this is really about something other than yoga, because those postures they're doing are gymnastics to me. It's not yoga asana. But if that's going to awaken them to what is their inner self, then that's their process. It's okay. They've got to go through it. You've got to give them the space to experience that. We all have needs. We all have the basic drives and needs from each chakra. And the Manipur chakra drives us to express our ego. So we either do that in a grandiose way or less than that. So somewhere we find the balance. Yeah. And what will happen is one day the person will wake up and be embarrassed about what they've been doing. Yeah. So look, it's a process. I mean, there are so many people finding their way. In Tantra we say there are as many paths towards enlightenment as individual people. Yes, the groundwork may be the yama and niyama. It might be the cleansing techniques that we start with Hatha Yoga Pradipika. Or the groundwork might just be that you are inspired to get involved in yoga and then find which is your path, who is your teacher, and that may change after a while. You might do the physical aspect and find that you want to know more about the pranayama, so then you ask your teacher to teach more of that, or you go somewhere to learn more about that, and through that you may want to understand the bandha, the locks. Then you may want to understand the deeper aspects of meditation or not. You might want to go more into the pranic field and understand about energy. So it's all a journey. And as our awareness keeps expanding, we keep finding that we have more interests in yoga. Or not. We might just do the asana and we're happy doing that. Yeah, so we're all individual, no right and wrong. And even, you know, I mean, as I say, with all these brands of yoga, I think it's okay. Why not explore it? Yeah, find out more about yourself. Because you learn something about yourself in any of these aspects of yoga. You learn about yourself in anything that you do in life. When you live your life with that awareness of seeing yourself, that's yoga. That's the groundwork. For me, yoga nidra is the groundwork because you get to step back from yourself and you learn how to maintain that for longer and longer periods. Yeah. So from my perspective, that is the groundwork. And when you've got that, then you'll see what you're doing in your asana. And in yoga, the words, there are several words in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. He uses the word drashta. This means to witness objectively. And so there are many words, but yeah, if you get the idea of what this is, then you try to do it more and more and more in your life. So we're going to finish with three Aums, and we're going to focus at the eyebrow centre. And often when we do Aums, I say feel it in the throat moving up. But here we're just going to focus here. And so to feel where the eyebrow centre is and give you a sensation, if you want to, then you lick your index finger, wipe the saliva there, you'll feel a cool sensation. And you focus at that point. When you inhale, if you like, you can imagine inhaling to this point, breathing in deeply.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Swami Muktibodhananda, visit muktibodharetreatscanada.com. Mukti, M-U-K-T-I, Bodha, B-O-D-H-A, retreatscanada.com.